As I walk through the wilderness of this world, I lighted upon a certain place where there was a den. And I lay down in that den and slept. And as I slept, I dreamed. And in my dream, I saw a man standing in a certain place with a heavy burden on his back and a book in his hand. And I heard him exclaim, "What shall I do?" That is the opening sentence of the book of a man who walked this earth 3 centuries ago. The title of that book is The Pilgrim's Progress from This World to That Which Is to Come, delivered in the form of a similitude, an allegory, wherein is described the manner of his setting out, his dangerous journey, and at last his safe arrival at the desired country. His name, of course, is John Bunyan. B-U-N-Y-A-N. It has nothing to do with an enlarged toe joint. English, 17th century. Only a man, but a man whom God singularly used. When he was brought before a magistrate, the judge asked him about his education. And he said, "I can read and write, both with difficulty." A second grade education. An ungodly young man. I want to tell you the story of his life. I want to ask you to use your imagination and accept the idea that I am he. I have come to tell you the story of my life as if I were John Bunyan. The apostle pled with heaven 3 times for the removal of a thorn in the flesh. And 3 times the Spirit of God responded, "My grace is sufficient for thee." This became the theme of my life. My middle and later life, but it was not the theme of my early life. Many times throughout that life, God showed his grace more than sufficient for me. Born to an honorable family, tradesman, commoner, a tinker was my dad, a tinker. Now, most of you don't know what a tinker is. You use the word tinkering in somewhat different manner. A tinker was a worker in metal, a metalsmith, who in my day, when pots or pans or instruments of barn or kitchen wore out, they were not discarded and easily replaced. They were repaired by a tinker who went from village to village with a portable brazier and repaired pots and pans and implements of barn and kitchen. It was a needful occupation whose services were long anticipated as he moved from village to village. The village was Elstow, where we live, Ellen's Stockade, Helena, the mother of Constantine, back in the 4th century. This town under Roman times was named after Ellen's Stockade, Elstow. It was about 3 miles from Bedford, which became a more familiar name associated with my history. A very simple and abbreviated education. My mother died when I was very young, My father married again, and there was a mutual combustion between me and her. We never got along. I was proud of being an ungodly boy. I say this now with great embarrassment from the other side of grace. I set out to be a wonder in the town. People did not want to be near me, fearful that God would wreak judgment upon me, and they didn't want to be near me when it happened. I set out to be the baddest little boy I could be. I lied, I swore, I upset the town in any way I could. I resorted to bell ringing, for example. In my time, when news was passed throughout the village, it was done by the ringing of the church bell. The church bell was the instrument of communication. There were high-tone bells that suggested joy and merriment and celebration. And there were low and mournful tones that suggested disaster. Whenever the church bells rang at times other than services, the whole town took notice and wondered and gathered and sought to discover the news. What was it? I would ring the bell at odd times when there was no news, just to upset the town and cause them to gather and discover there was no news. I played Sunday sports, which in my time was unacceptable. I lied, I swore, I deceived, but by the grace of God, I was not drunken, I was not unchaste. God in His grace kept me from those grosser sins. Years later, when my testimony was besmirched by enemies and I was charged with the moral turpitude, I could reply, if all the fornicators and adulterers of England were hanged by the neck till they be dead, John Bunyan would be still alive. But that was no credit to me. That was the grace of God who preserved me. At the age of 16, I joined the Parliamentarian Army. This was in the 1640s. Oliver Cromwell was our general. I went away from home and joined the army, and several times during that experience, God kept me from mortal danger. On one occasion, I was assigned to a certain post in the providence of God. Before the attainment of that post, I was replaced by someone else, and that someone else in that very night had his head destroyed by a cannonball. But for the grace of God, that would have been I. It was not for nothing that my later autobiography was titled Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. On two occasions, I escaped drowning. Came back, now about 18 years old, to my hometown. Married a young, poor lady, girl. So poor that at her father's death, the only dowry she received from him was two tattered books. One was titled The Practice of Piety. The other was The Plain Man's Pathway to Heaven. Together we read those two books. I say together, it took both of us to read them. And in them I saw something very different from my life. And I now set about, after the birth of our first daughter, we named her Mary after her mother. She was born blind. She was a tender burden of love. We named her after her mother. Blind Mary was her name. And now I'm a family man, and I need to set an example for my family. And now I proceed to wear a different robe, a robe of righteousness of my own making. And I set about now to substitute for what had been my reputation, an opposite reputation of my own making. I now wanted to be a wonder in the town for the opposite reason. But I knew nothing of the grace of God. I was setting about to establish my own righteousness, which would be a garment of rags. I learned my father's trade. I became a tinker and earned my living thus. But I had a certain pricking after God, is the way I put it. The Spirit of God was working in my soul. And I was searching, and I knew not what. But I knew I had not what I needed. Thought we ought to go to church because it would be a good example for the children. Soon there were four children. Before Mary died, before my wife died, we attended the little Baptist church. I later said I was less attuned to the order of Baptists than to the doctrine. The polity didn't mean as much to me as the teaching. Pastor Gifford was the pastor of the little Baptist church in Bedford, to which we had moved, 3 miles away from Elstow. Pastor Gifford, a good and godly man who preached a tender gospel of grace. And every time I heard him preach, he would end his message with an appeal to the hearers to close with Christ. Close with Christ. A breach sin had created. Christ had provided the bridge in Jesus Christ. Now you must close, come to a closure with him. And soon as Pastor Gifford would close his message, appealing to us to close with Christ, I found the water stood in my eyes. But I would not let it fall. And then, 2 events. I came upon a group of 4 ladies in Pastor Gifford's church who were idly talking with each other on the porch, you would say, the doorstep of one of them. And they were ignorant of my overhearing them, but they were commenting on the beauties of the grace of God, the joys of heaven. They were rejoicing together as natural expressions of the grace of God in their hearts. The grace of God for them was the divine life kindled in the soul. That's the way they put it. And they had something very different from rules and regulations and do's and don'ts. They had an effervescent joy. That was one experience. The other was one day overhearing my dear Mary, my wife, praying for me. And again, she did not know I was within earshot. She prayed, and this I will never forget. Dear God, help my poor husband. He is more sightless than Mary. And the next time Pastor Gifford preached, the next time he said, close with Christ, the next time the water stood in my eyes, I let it fall. And I came to know the grace of God. At the age of 25, I'm baptized in the river by Pastor Gifford. And now what I had long sought, I now possessed. What I had once sought to imitate was now genuine. And I set about to give my testimony wherever I could. Haltingly, untutored, but soon seeking a minute textual knowledge of the words of the Word of God. And God filled my soul with His book. I continued tinkering from town to town. That was my living. But I would preach wherever I was given the opportunity. I would go to farmhouses and walk several miles to different distant towns. And wherever a group was gathered, and soon by invitation, they would seek my presence and my preaching. And God was giving fruit. And I once said, if I be fruitless, it matters not who condemns me. But if I be fruitful, I care not. I've misstated it. If I be fruitless, it matters not who commends me. But if I be fruitful, I care not who condemns. I became known as the ignorant tinker. One day, the Puritan scholar, John Owen, Dr. Owen, was asked why he would go to hear that ignorant tinker preach. And Dr. Owen, learned man of Puritan heritage, replied, oh, sir, I would gladly give all my learning if I could preach like that ignorant tinker. Pastor Gifford died. Mr. Bedford became the pastor for a couple of years before he died, and then I became the pastor of this little Baptist church. And then pretty soon, the government changed. Charles I was king, and a conventicle and test act was passed by the parliament. And it was unlawful now to attend other than ecclesiastically sanctioned public service. It was unlawful to preach except by the authorization of the Church of England, the national church. I had got my orders from heaven, not from any ecclesiastical organization. Any unlawful meeting was suspect, fearful of the fomenting of revolution or opposition to the crown. And therefore, there could be no unauthorized assembly for any purpose. Now, The magistrate in my hometown was conscious that I was not seditious or a threat to sobriety and propriety under the law, and yet the law had to be upheld. And on one occasion, I was 13 miles away from my home, having gone to a farmhouse in a distant town there to preach, having been invited by those who assembled neighbors into the farmhouse. And news was sent ahead prior to the beginning of the service that the magistrate was coming to arrest me for unlawful assembly. Now, what shall I do? These people have invited me to preach. God has commissioned me to preach. I have taught and preached that God is able to succor and sustain all those who are His. Shall I flee now and leave them as a coward? I went out behind the house before the meeting time and prayed to heaven and felt assured that I should proceed as had been planned. I proceeded to preach. The magistrate arrived. I acknowledged his presence and requested his patience while I finished my message. I announced my text. Dost thou believe God? And the sheriff trembled in his seat. I said, behold how this man trembles at the word of God. And by implication, why do not you? I preached. I finished my preaching. I presented myself to this representative of the law. He said, I am required to arrest you, sir. I am proceeding to Bedford Town. Follow me. He did not make any effort to restrain me or to contain me. He hoped I would escape. He did not want to have to deal with this, which was not a threat to the government. He knew. He proceeded to walk ahead. I followed him the 13 miles to Bedford Town, where I was placed in the jail. Bedford Jail, a phrase that has come to be well known. 1 month incarceration before a trial, before the magistrate. A jail in my time, strangely, included as its inhabitants three groups of people. Criminals, who should be there. The insane, for whom there was no other institution in those days, and debtors. It always seemed to me stupid to incarcerate debtors. They surely would never pay their debts if you put them in jail. But indiscriminately, together, were these three groups of people. In those days, the government did not provide food for prisoners. Their families had to provide whatever food they consumed, and the straw that covered the stone floor on which they lay. My poor family now, including blind Mary and her sisters and her mother, with no source of livelihood. But I had no shortage of a congregation in prison. There were many who needed the gospel I preached. But I was troubled and in spiritual pain at what I was doing to my own family. And the magistrate dwelled on that when I was brought to trial. There exists in your day the record of my trial before the magistrate. That is where that expression, "I can read and write and both with difficulty," emerged. The magistrate said, "Think of your children and your wife. Think of your blind daughter. Think of the unnecessary pain you bring upon them. When but for the promise of a signature on a document that you will not again call people to assembly and preach to them without the authorization of the Church of England as the law requires. You in your century, in your land, cannot understand the control of the church by the national government. You have been the product of the blessings of liberty, liberty of belief." The magistrate said to me, "You mean everybody of all religions should have equal opportunity to present their doctrines? That would be chaos," he said. In my day, it was the duty of the state to care for the souls of the subjects no less than the bodies. And I said, "Every Mohammedan," I said, "you would say Muslim. Every papist," you would say Catholic. "Every man of any religious stripe should be free to teach his doctrine, because God alone teaches his people the truth. And when you coerce outward allegiance to any man-made decree, you create hypocrites or rebels." And the magistrate bent over backwards and said, "All right, I will not require you to sign a document. Just give me your word that you will not call together groups to which to preach. Now, if others call them and you go to preach to them, that'll be okay." But this was obviously skirting the intent of the law, and it was not an honest agreement. I refused. I said, "No government has the right to give me the authorization to preach. God has given me that, and I will surrender it to no human institution." "Well, then you leave me no choice," the magistrate said. "I sentence you to 6 years in prison." In prison, I was conscious of the concern for my family. I was able to acquire a large spool of heavy twine and a smaller spool of very thin thread. And I cut that thick twine into lengths which could serve as laces for boots and shoes. And at each end, I would take the thin thread and wind an inch or so to stiffen the ends, thus to make it possible to put them in through eyelets. These were tagged laces, tag, T-A-G, tagged laces. The tagging was the stiffening of the ends. And I would pass them through the cell bars to my children to sell on the street corner. I had remembered the psalmist said, "I once was young, now I am old, and I have never seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread." I did not want my godly seed to be begging bread and denying the truth that God would supply their needs. I was reluctant to take food from my family for myself. How little they possess. There was placed outside my cell, within reachable distance through the bars, a paper, a document, which if I were to sign it any day of any week of any month, I would be released immediately. That paper was my promise that I would not preach without the authorization of the Church of England, and I would not preach to any gathered assembly contrary to the law. I could have been released any day if I would sign it. Then I declared that I will not sign that paper if moss grows on my eyebrows. And given the bushiness of my eyebrows and the dampness of the cell, that was not an impossible thought. By the way, I had red hair and a walrus kind of mustache that went down and up. I had a lusty voice, a broad frame, red hair, I say, and that was my build and my characteristic. So moss growing on these bushy was a distinct possibility. That paper was regularly replaced as mice consumed it from time to time, but it was never signed. 6 years in the prison. After 6 years, released. Within 3 months, rearrested and sentenced to 6 years more. From the age of 32, I was born in 1628, until my age 45, except for a few months in 1666, I was in prison. Released in 66, I say, for a few months. By this time, Mary, my wife, had died. I married again with these four small children. Elizabeth was her name, and by her had two subsequent children. Was rearrested later in 1666, remained in prison until 1672. By then, changes in the government had authorized my release. 3 years passed, and then I was rearrested and sentenced for 6 months. In 1675, I say this because one would think that 12 years in prison for preaching the gospel, no other vice, would have been sufficient. But were it not for this six-month sentence in 1675, I may perhaps not have been remembered by you. It was in that final imprisonment that I conceived the idea of the Pilgrim's Progress, began its writing, and in 1678 it was published. I cannot imagine how God has used that little book. In the first writing, there were several pages in succession in which there was no word of more than two syllables. My vocabulary was simple. My library consisted of two books, the Bible and John Fox's Book of Martyrs. Later, when young theologues came to visit me from London, they asked to see my library. I showed them those two books and the publisher's copies of other things I had written in the course of a lifetime, some 60 works altogether. In 60 years, someone has estimated 1 million words in those. They were not all volumes. Some of them were tracts, booklets, and others, like the one you're featuring in your book room this week. The Holy War, many of you know that book. Grace Abounding, my autobiography. The Pilgrim's Progress. The Pilgrim's Progress has enabled me to minister to tens of millions the world over whom I could never meet this side of glory. It was published in original edition, then in expanded editions, then in different languages, and then republished. It has been declared to be the most widely read book in the world that was written originally in English. In more languages, in more editions, in more versions. And it was written by an ignorant tinker of Bedford who came late in life to the realization of the grace of God that it describes, and which God used in ways he could never imagine. My last experience was a journey to a distant town to act as a mediator between a father and his son. The father had disowned the son for some breach, and the son appealed to me to accompany him to mediate and see if there could be reconciliation. The son desired reconciliation. The father was adamant. God gave some measure of success in that journey. The two were reconciled. I left them in each other's arms. Made my way back home, but in the rain-filled journey back home, I acquired what we call the sweating sickness and passed from this life in 1688. Just 2 months short of my 60th year. Buried in Bunhill Field, across from John Wesley's house. John Wesley is 18th century, I'm 17th century, but in a plot of land now greatly disheveled, with gravestones and above-ground tombs, 3 centuries old, many of them. Bunhill Field, Bone Hill, where the dissenters were buried, where in my same plot, the same cemetery lies the remains of Susanna Wesley, the mother of John, and a dozen others. Isaac Watts, the hymn writer whom you know, Daniel Defoe, others, some of them below ground, others, I say, in above ground. Markers are hardly legible today. But John Bunyan's grave is there as well. But look not there for me. Look in the books that God has been pleased to disseminate the world over. God uses, I repeat to you, God uses human instruments to accomplish divine purpose. He does not always, in fact, he does not often, hold back the forces of nature and turn back the sun and cause her to cease from her going down. He does not often interfere with the laws which he has ordained. But he can take the simplest thing and turn the greatest consequence. God be pleased. He uses individuals. He has in times past. He is doing it today. He can use you. He can use me. The grace of God was sufficient for John Bunyan. It has been, will be, ever sufficient for all who embrace his Son. Let it be true that for you, the testimony is that of a divine life kindled in the soul. To him be praise. Amen.